item number 16, Columbia Basin Partnership, and that's a briefing. So, Dan and Bill, are you involved in this too? No.
Good morning, Chair Smith. I am on. Good morning, Chair Smith, Commissioners, Director Sisslin, Assistant Director Storr. My name is Dan Rodding, and I work on Columbia River Sand Recovery Issues Department. And today I'm here to provide you an overview of a process called the NOAA's Columbia Basin Partnership and their development of provisional salmon and steelhead recovery goals. And oftentimes when we think about salmon recovery, many people think about recovery as being delisting or getting off of ESA. There's a second part to recovery, and that's actually restoring salmon and steelhead to healthy numbers. And which then provides us an opportunity for meaningful harvest opportunity. And this process is not focused on delisting, but it's focused on after we achieve delisting, what might we look like in the basin for healthy and harvestable populations. So today I wanted to briefly go through Washington's approach to salmon recovery, just revisit some history here, talk about the rationale for the creation of the partnership, the purpose and goals of the partnership, present some provisional goals, and close with a summary and some next steps. So in the late 90s, salmon in the Columbia Basin were proposed for listing by NOAA, and at that time, Governor Locke got together his Joint Natural Resource Council, and they developed a paper or a report called the Statewide Strategy to Recover Salmon, Extinction is Not an Option. And even back in, so we're having a deal with fish that are close to extinction or wanting to move them to delisting. But even at that time, we recognized in the state of Washington that we need to restore salmon populations to healthy and harvestable levels. So while we have a short-term focus on recovery, we're really, from the salmon recovery perspective, we're really talking about ultimate goal of healthy and harvestable. And in order to do that, we've got to go ahead and address the habitat issues. So from extinction is not an option, there's a couple of takeaways, which should be no surprise to you all. First, salmon are culturally significant to the citizens of Washington. They're part of our history, they're part of our culture, economy, and recreation. Also, salmon are a key part of our ecosystem. By protecting salmon, we also address our clean water needs as well. And then the third key part of extinction is not an option is that salmon recovery efforts need to be locally based. Top-down approaches from government don't always work. So, and salmon recovery is just not about the Department of Fish and Wildlife getting, developing recovery goals and going off and doing that by itself. Salmon are integrated across the state with many diverse interests, and they have salmon recovery actions have big effect on economics, and we're in a state that's growing. So we have to be smart and we have to be conscious when we think about salmon recovery. So in summary, the Washington way is what, and I think you've had some presentations in the past from the Governor's Salmon Recovery Office, basically is that there was a Salmon Recovery Act that was passed in 99. It created salmon recovery boards across the state. In the Columbia, we have four of them, three in the Columbia and one in the Snake. And then it created a funding mechanism called the Salmon Funding Recovery Board to go ahead and fund the recovery actions that are needed for salmon. In the Columbia, the recovery boards went ahead and developed their local recovery plans. with state agencies and local governments, and those have been adopted by NOAA. Both the current state and federal recovery plans focus on ESA delisting and not on what we call broad sense recovery or healthy and harvestable goals. So now I'm going to jump to the Columbia Basin. So the Columbia Basin is pretty large. Basin's about the size of France. About 15% is in Canada. I don't have a pointer, but I do have this. This is Chief Joseph here. So we have this entire area that is blocked. Salmon had access to at least this part of the area. On the Snake River, the Hell's Canyon complex blocks a lot of salmon habitat that had access all the way up through the Boise area. So the Columbia steel, or salmon and steelhead distribution has been severely truncated. There are 13 of the 24 ESUs or stocks that are listed within the Columbia Basin. So when we take a look at a situational landscape of the Columbia River, the first thing that we notice is that the lawyers are really having fun in the Columbia. We have been in litigation ourselves as a state, NOAA, since the 1980s for salmon recovery matters, including the role of hatchery fish, operation of the Columbia River hydro system, harvest rates for ESA salmon, on and on and on. NOAA had a situational assessment done by the Ruckelshaus Center and Oregon Consensus, and they had a couple key findings. First was that a more coherent, integrated, and efficient means of addressing the complexities of salmon recovery is needed. The second thing is identifying common goals and measuring progress and success for salmon recovery across the entire region are needed. So in based on the situational assessment, NOAA solicited stakeholders through a formal process, requested state and tribal representatives from sovereigns, and began the Columbia Basin Partnership Task Force. And I'm just going to call this the partnership. It's got 25 members from states and tribes, as well as diverse interests, including NGOs and environmental representatives, commercial fishing, recreational fishing, utilities, river industry representatives, agriculture and irrigation, and a local recovery representative from each state. The department, all of the Fish and Wildlife departments are actually not part, formal members of the partnership. The governor's office in each of the four states is actually the representative on the partnership. So my role in the partnership has been to support our governor's representative, Mr. Guy Norman, who's also on the Northwest Power and Conservation Council. So the purpose of the partnership, develop common and shared goals for Columbia River Basin, anadromous salmon, and steelhead. So to do that, we need to facilitate achieving existing management, mitigation, and recovery responsibilities. We also need to implement a more coherent and integrated means of addressing the complexities of salmon recovery. And then the third goal is, within the regional process, engage the sovereigns and stakeholders to develop goals for healthy and harvestable. And no one has really done this healthy and harvestable part. People have focused on delisting, but getting to where we would like to be has really never been done. And that was what I think is one of the biggest accomplishments of the partnership so far. So when we talk about goals, we want to deal with both conservation and we want to deal with harvest or fishing opportunities. We want the goals to be understandable, and they've got to balance all of the user groups that use the Columbia Basin. Columbia Basin, while I like to think of it as a home for salmon and steelhead, other people have other views of the Columbia Basin, including hydro, including irrigation, barging. So we have to go, if we're going to develop cohesive and agreeable goals, everyone's got to be part of that. Today I'm going to talk about some qualitative and quantitative goals for spawning escapements and for harvest. The fourth outcome was better coordination and more efficient use of resources. And through the partnership, it was hoped that the partners would be able to enhance relationships, trust, and knowledge of the diverse user groups across the Columbia Basin. So I'm just going to go over real briefly a timeline and a work chart for this. So the partnership started in January of 17, and it started with some engagement and a framework operating principles. And then it also started at the same time on this policy framework, which included a vision and some quantitative goals. At the same time, all of these things needed to keep the values that we had in mind, some ecological, social, cultural, and economic values. So in order to do this, what we started out was we called them prototypes or – thank you. We call them prototypes or work groups, where we actually went to an ESU and we started at the population level and we asked how many fish are returning, how many hatchery, how many are wild. We looked at historic information on how many used to be there. That was either recorded or modeled. And then we went through these five prototypes across the basin, and we learned a bunch of those. And those were in a feedback loop that helped us modify our qualitative goals. And then that actually led to developing goals then for the 24 stock groups or 242 populations across the basin. And we completed that work this summer. And the next step in the process is we're doing some outreach right now, just talking about the accomplishments of the partnership. And then this will go to NOAA's Marine Affairs Advisory Committee in January of next year. So today what I'm here to talk to you about primarily are some qualitative goals, some quantitative goals for wild or natural origin spawners, some harvest goals, and some hatchery goals. So the products that I'm going to overview is basically a draft statement, vision statement, some qualitative goals. I'm not going to have time to get into 242 populations, but I would love to talk to you about those if you would like to. And I'm actually not even going to be able to get into the 24 ESUs. I'm going to try to provide you a high-level summary of those. So qualitative goal is, so the vision is a healthy Columbia River Basin ecosystem with thriving salmon and steelhead that are indicators of clean and abundant water, reliable and clean energy, robust regional economy, vibrant cultural and spiritual traditions, and independent and existing in harmony. And that was the vision statement from the group. So with it, based on that qualitative vision statement, we went ahead and were able to go ahead and develop, I'm going to go through the four goals that happened. So the first goal here is to restore salmon and steelhead in the Columbia Basin to healthy and harvestable levels. Within those, we have sub-goals, prevent decline, achieve delisting, achieve broad sense or healthy and harvestable, expand spatial and temporal range, expand diversity and resiliency. And then up across the top, there's a timeline. Within 25 years, we would like this to happen. Within 50, within 100 years, and so on. I'm not going to go through all of these. I'll just pick out one of these as I go through each one of these and just sort of walk through those. So in terms of broad sense recovery, within 25 years, make significant measurable progress towards broad sense recovery goals. So in other words, we're hoping that within 25 years, some of the populations we will be able to get to be delisted. Within 50 years, achieve harvestable, healthy and harvestable levels for some more of the populations. And within 100 years, get there for all of the populations. The next goal, number two, is provide diverse, productive, and dependable tribal and non-tribal harvest and fishing opportunities, both in freshwater and the marine environment. Again, we have three different sub-goals: sustainability, optimized harvest and fishing opportunity, and shared benefits. And they each have timelines. I'm just going to focus on the optimize the harvest and fishery opportunity. So right now, because of ESA, many of our populations are constrained. So even though we have marked selective fisheries, we run up against incidental impacts when we catch those ESA-listed fish, and those constrain our fisheries on hatchery fish. So the first one is optimize fishery opportunity and access harvestable surplus of unlisted hatchery stocks consistent with conservation. So as we move forward and we start getting to recovery, we think we will be able to have higher harvest rates on hatchery fish. And then within 50 years, expand opportunity related to progress, and we would be able to experience higher harvest rates. And finally, realize potential harvest opportunity or increased harvest opportunity on both hatchery and wild stocks. The third goal is to produce hatchery salmon and steelhead to support conservation, mitigation, and fisheries that aligns hatchery production and natural recovery goals. And again, sub-goals support natural production, mitigate for loss production, and some fish protection. So from a fish protection perspective, we want to make sure that the hatchery production is lined up with recovery goals and consistent with mitigation responsibilities. We talked, showed you a little bit about there's 144 dams on the Columbia. There's a lot of mitigation for hatchery fish that goes on there. So continuing to implement hatchery practices, best practices, to provide hatchery fish for harvest. Continue to refine hatchery and production strategies out 50 years and trying to minimize impacts, hatchery impacts on natural produced salmon and steelhead. And finally, reduce the long-term hatchery impacts by rebuilding natural populations. And the fourth goal gets at this idea about the broad interest within the Columbia Basin. Make sure that the decisions reflect the full range of social, cultural, economic, and economic ecosystem values and diversity in the Columbia. And an example of that is a social goal, which is to make decisions that reflect the social importance of steelhead to everyone in the Columbia region, recognizing everyone's social values. So that's sort of an overview of the qualitative goals. So if we were to go ahead and try to take a look at a graph of everything that I just talked about, if we took a look at salmon or habitat status, since salmon are inextricably linked to their habitat, from an ESA perspective, we have extinction, endangered, threatened, delisting. So that means we're finally starting to get into the bottom edge of healthy. And then we're in this green zone of broad sense or healthy. And then we also recognize that we're in pristine or there are some historic conditions. So if we look at what this trajectory that I just talked about qualitatively would look like is that currently we have 13 of 24 populations that are listed. We'd like to get to some ESA recovery within this time and get to some broad sense recovery. And then within 50 to 100 years, we'd like to get into this healthy and harvestable range and ideally towards the top end. The discussions within the partnership recognize, given where we are within the Columbia Basin, we are never going to get to pristine habitat conditions, and we are never going to get to historic potential. So what we tried to do is look at what good salmon habitat might look like and how many fish that might produce. So now I'm going to go through a little bit about how we set some goals for natural origin. So the low range of healthy and harvestable was delisting. So what does it take to make sure that these fish don't get delisted? The high range, we took a look at some healthy aspirational and harvestable levels that might be achieved with aggressive improvements across the system. And then we took look at a mid-range, which was basically splitting the difference between the low and the high. I just wanted to put this slide up there to just highlight a little bit of sort of what we did for each population. I don't expect to go through in a lot of detail. But for each population, the 242 we looked at the recent 10-year abundance. We looked at the historical information on what it could have been, and this is for mid-Columbia steelhead. We took a look at delisting goals. We took a look at what aspirational high-level escapement goals might be, and we got the mid-range. Then we took these goals and transferred them over here in sort of a dashboard summary. Currently, here we are. Here's the low goal, the mid goal, the high goal, and historically where we were at. So that sort of makes some sense to folks. We also did the same thing for hatchery production for the different populations where we put place hatchery fish. We summarized these in a pie chart. I don't have the harvest on here, but we have about a 10% harvest rate for mid-Columbia steelhead. About 6.5% is in the Zone 6 or treaty fishery, and the remaining 4% are in sport fisheries and commercial fisheries, and that's through marked selective fisheries and the impacts to steelhead from wild steelhead release. And then we just tried to summarize this in a one-page dashboard where we highlighted the scope of the ESU, maybe some limiting factors where the hatchery production was and where reintroduction programs were going on. And so we have these for all of the 24 different ESUs. So now I'm trying to move up a level and talk a little bit about where we ended up for goals. So I have each species within the Columbia, species and race within the Columbia Basin within this column, the recent 10-year average natural origin returns, the low goal, the mid goal, the high goal, what the historic numbers were, and what the high goal represents in terms of the proportion of the historic. So the high goal for spring Chinook is 17% of the historic goal. So we did these for all populations. We can just take a look. Spring Chinook as an example. We're at about 30,000. The low goal is 68,000. And ultimately, we'd like to get to about 250,000. Some of these may look a little bit funny. So right now for fall Chinook, we're actually at 134,000. You say, that's higher than the 80,000. Why is that? Well, that's because we have fall Chinook in the mid-Columbia area, the Deschutes area, Hanford Reach that are not listed that are actually doing better, achieving returns higher than their goals. So anyway, summarizing, low goal for natural origin fish is about 600,000, 1.4 million for the mid goal and the high goal of near 3 million. And I'm going to just real briefly talk. I can't get through all the harvest rates, but I wanted to give you some sense of sort of harvest rates and sort of what we've, of spawning escapements for different groups and sort of where we are. So for Upper Columbia Spring Chinook, our spawning escapement is in the thousands now. We have a goal of between 6,000 and 30,000, and so we're well below that. For Snake River Falls Chinook, the abundance goal that we are currently seeing is within the range of what we would expect to see. But I want to caution you that ESA delisting depends on more than just abundance. There's three other criteria that are in there. But it indicates the progress we've made on Snake River Falls Chinook. Mid-Columbia steelhead, again, we're slightly below the low end of delisting, and we have a ways to go towards achieving high end. And Lower Columbia coho, a similar pattern of about 30,000 fish returning and wanting to get to 60 to 140,000. So we have some way to go. In terms of harvest rates, so right now, Upper Columbia River Spring Chinook are constrained usually to an average of about 11%. But we manage fish based on abundance-based management. So that means in years when the ocean is not productive or we have low ocean returns, we're going to be closer to 6%. In years where we have high ocean returns, we're going to be closer to 18% for Upper Columbia Spring Chinook. So if we take a look then as what we might expect as we move from the low goal to the mid goal to the high recovery goal, we would expect that we would have now harvest opportunities either directly or indirectly on these fish. Those would increase with time. Snake River Falls Chinook are very productive right now. We have goals between 30 and 70%. We think that's appropriate. But as we rebuild that population, we think the average harvest is going to go from the low 40s to the high 40%. For summer, mid-Columbia summer steelhead, a similar pattern, and lower Columbia coho, a similar pattern. So we're expecting, as we recover these populations, we're still going to have to manage fish on abundance-based management based on how the ocean is going to go, but we're going to have more opportunities. And then just real briefly, some hatchery production, just to give you a scale of what's going on within the Columbia Basin. We release many millions of hatchery fish within the basin. These are primarily mitigation programs due to Mitchell Act, due to Bonneville Power Administration and core construction of dams. And they are spread across the basin from the lower Columbia all the way to the upper Columbia. I would focus that right now, in the partnership, the planned increases were largely associated with trying to reestablish some salmon populations above Grand Coulee Dam. And the blue bars are the current production. And in terms of where we are for hatchery production, we have about 1.4 million hatchery salmon and steelhead that return to the mouth of the Columbia. Spring Chinook average around 200,000, fall Chinook 400,000, coho 400,000, and summer steelhead about 300,000. These are recent 10-year averages from 2008 through 17 and doesn't reflect the unfortunate condition that we're in today or this year. These were developed largely over the last year, and these don't reflect any recent discussions regarding southern resident killer whales or some of the actions that you folks have recently taken. So trying to wrap this up, Columbia Basin partnership summary. We've got agreement across a diverse group of basin interests for what healthy and harvestable is. We've regionally adopted these goals, or regional adoption of these goals will hopefully change the Columbia River landscape and move away from this adversarial landscape of litigation to coherent, integrated, and efficient partnership as we move forward. NOAA is going to use this information or the goals recommended by the task force for its future management decisions. And probably most importantly is that the healthy and harvestable goals keep the focus away from just getting delisting or one fish past what's needed for extinction, to actually provide healthy and harvestable goals or meaningful fishing opportunity, which is consistent with the agency mission. Next steps, the partnership is going to submit a report to NOAA's Marine Fisheries Advisory Committee, and the report needs to be approved by them. And while we have focused on some aspirational goals, part two of the partnership is to actually get down and do some heavy lifting and take a look at what it would actually take to achieve those mid-level goals in terms of actions and economics and what it would take to achieve those quantitative high-level goals. So that's a really high overview of the partnership, and I'm happy to answer any questions, and there is a lot more information on NOAA's website.
Thank you. That was very interesting. Just one question out of the gate. Looking at the activities of the ORCA task force, the issue of the Snake River dams surfaces, has the partnership looked at that issue?
So the partnership has not looked at that specific issue. The partnership has really looked at sort of what would be goals that would that the users could come around and support. That phase two is what are the actions needed to get to those goals. Okay. I believe the partnership would weigh in on things like dam breaching and restoration and other things that would be needed to achieve those goals.
Thank you.
But to that, speaking to that, he can go back and show one of his slides. Even if the four lower Snake River dams were taken out, there would still be 80% of the historic spawning grounds behind dams. So it isn't like if you pull those dams, it opens up millions and millions of acres that aren't going to still be behind a dam.
No, I understand. I'm just reflecting on what the director and I witnessed at the last whale meeting. I mean, there's a lot of emotion around that, and a lot of verbiage going on, and you know, and we had a webinar recently about it as well. So it's yeah.
But that's what it is emotion and not numbers.
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I find it curious, too, that you on page 25, you have a whole slide dedicated to, if I'm reading this right, planned hatchery releases for the Upper Columbia above Grand Coulee Dam. And, you know, that just seems odd that that's, because that's still just a vision. There's a lot of work that needs to be done on that. I mean, a lot of work, because even if we can manage passage over both Chief Joseph and Grand Coulee, getting the fish back down or fish behavior in an environment that's changed. Lake Roosevelt is a lake. It's not a river anymore. And so it's a big question about how fish behavior is going to be altered by that circumstance compared to other areas of the Columbia. And so it just seems like there's quite a bit of emphasis on that that is a long way out. And another question, sorry, are you familiar with the Yakima Basin work? Is this different? Are you developing this in parallel to what the work they're doing?
So we got two questions for me. So
I'll start with the first
Roosevelt first, and then I'll circle back around to Yakima.
Okay.
So as part of the partnership, we have Upper Columbia tribes, uh-huh. and it's culturally it's very important for them to resource some salmon to that area.
Yeah.
I totally agree with you that it will take time to do that. But they've identified that as a priority, and the partnership has agreed that planning for some future releases to if that's the direction we end up going, they wanted to go ahead and identify that right up front within in the plan. So agree. Lake Roosevelt fluctuates 100 feet. It's going to be challenging to get juveniles out, maybe less challenging to get adults back, but the reintroduction efforts are always challenging, but that was part of what the Upper Columbia tribes brought to the partnership, and it was important value for them. Circling back around to the Yakima, we had representatives from the Yakima Integrated Plan, mm-hmm. and one of the Kittitas Irrigation District on there, and so we leveraged as we were looking at opportunities on that mid-sea steelhead slide that I showed you. We were engaged in sort of what was going on in the Yakima and to build off of that. We weren't trying to create any new work here. We used existing information from Yakima Integrated Plan, from sub-basin plans in the Columbia, from a whole bunch of sources, and we tried to build off of that. We didn't try to reinvent the wheel, and we tried to bring diverse partners together in those work groups to get at those goals of low, medium, and high.
Yeah, I just, you know, I'm aware of sort of a parallel development of the plan with the Yakima Basin Integrated Group. We're undergoing a review of the Upper Columbia Fishery Management Plan ourselves. And so I just see a lot of parallel work being done. And I'm not sure, I know you have a diverse group that's been involved with the development of this, but I'm wondering, I'm not happy with your timeline. I don't think the public is going to be very happy with your timeline. And I'm just not sure how much awareness. Well, you know, I think we've had a sense that people want to see recovery on a little more accelerated path. And it's a little nervous about, you know, I don't know our role in this other than to look at it, but I'm a little bit nervous about this going forward, as you say, to the Office of NOAA to get their blessing when there's other plans being developed and also a very urgent need from the public to see results faster than your timeline indicates. I don't think that's real in terms of the social and economic needs of the state and what the people of the state expect from both the commercial and recreational side. That's just my first blush at looking at this.
Thank you for those comments. I agree that I think everyone here would like to see an accelerated time frame. When the recovery plans were first developed in the 2000s, the 25-year horizon represented what people thought they could do to get to delisting. Remember, delisting is really linked to the habitat or the ecosystem of the fish. It's very difficult to recover an ecosystem quickly and salmon habitat. So I agree. I think I would like to see us accelerate and get to delisting quickly. But realistically, to get to some of these longer-term goals, I think it's going to be, unless there's a lot of funding available, and we'll find out in the phase two in terms of doing the red face test, sort of like what does it take to do this in terms of resources, then I think we can sharpen those timelines. And I think that will be important once we know exactly what actions we need to do and sort of the cost of those actions.
Well, you know, I understand that, but I recall a meeting that took place 10 years ago, and there was a consultant there that, you know, was working with utilities at the time, and it was pretty much specific to steelhead recovery in the Upper Columbia, particularly the Mattow, Wenatchee, those rivers. And when he mentioned a 30-year timeline for expectation for recovery or delisting, he was practically thrown out of the room. I just want you to know that this is highly academic. I appreciate the work you've done, but it's not fitting with expectations from the public, both the recreational and commercial sectors.
Okay, thank you.
Dan, really interesting presentation. My question's a little bit of a sideboard kind of question, coming from Region 1. We're kind of feeling good about the snake fall Chinook and potential for celebration, perhaps. So you mentioned that there are several requirements to meet delisting, and could you talk a little bit about those and what the process would be to get there?
Sure, absolutely. So there are basically, from a salmon recovery perspective, there's abundance, which we showed, and for Snake River Falls Chinook, we're there for abundance. So that's a plus. The other one is population sort of resilience. Mm-hmm. And so that would mean how fast could Snake River fish recover from poor ocean conditions or some catastrophic event. So that's the, it's called resilience or productivity. The third is called spatial structure. So are they all just spawning in the clear water? And are they not in the lower Salmon, the lower Grand Ron, and up towards Hell's Canyon? So we need to have good spatial structure. And the other thing is diversity. So do we have a diverse age structure of 3, 4, and 5-year-olds? Is there enough genetic diversity? So while I think we have done very well on abundance, and I think we're moving closer towards those other three, I think it may take another 5 to 10 years before we can able to demonstrate with some certainty about those other three. And so so right now they've modified a little bit in terms of the reintroduction program up there, and to be able to try to measure that spatial structure better, that diversity a little bit better. And I think if that can happen, I think it's possible that within the next 5 to 10 years, they could be delisted.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for the presentation, and thanks for all your effort on this and support and working with Guy Norman and being our representative in that forum. Slide 25 caught my attention, too. I have a question on the left-hand side and then a comment on the process for the right-hand side. So on the left-hand side here, if this is for the areas above Grand Coulee, 80 million fall Chinook caught my eye. You know, I used to think of the upper Columbia being summer Chinook country and maybe some spring Chinook, and we just talked about substantially enhancing hatchery abundance for killer whale prey and came up with 50 million as a proposal for consideration. This makes that look like a Piker's recommendation if you're looking at 80 million above Grand Coulee.
Yeah.
So is that what that really means?
Yeah, I think, Commissioner Markaisek, I didn't do a great job on the slide. So the current production is in blue. The planned additional production is in red. So for above Coulee, then for Fall Chinook, the proposal is for 15 million sub-yearlings to be released.
Above Grand Coulee?
Above Grand
Fall
Coulee.
Chinook.
Just the red is above Grand Coulee.
Okay, okay. In our killer whale general reference table, we had 600,000 summer Chinook and no fall Chinook. So this is interesting to see this. On the right-hand side, so we have a hatchery return goals. And you had indicated that this was a recent year average of, you know, for fall Chinook, for example, 400,000. Recent years, hatchery production are substantially less than what is commonly viewed as the mitigation debt for all the hydroelectric business that's gone on. Mitchell Act, for example, through the 60s and 70s, had
right.
80s, lots of reductions. So a lot of people might think, well, this is not a high enough goal because by choosing recent year averages, you've chosen, and not you, of course, the process has come up with some goals that are artificially low and don't really even cover the mitigation debt that people look at all around. And on spring Chinook, if you count, this is, I'm presuming on the right-hand side, is not just above Grand Coulee. This is the basin?
This is to the mouth of the Columbia.
Yeah, okay.
That's correct.
So when you count Willamette River and some other things like that, the spring Chinook goal looks a little shy as well, but that might be the recent year average. So it's kind of a policy decision of why did you pick the recent year average if it's, you know, I can't say cherry-picked to be low because 2015 was a boom year for
correct.
Chinook. But the process says that this recommendation will go to the Marine Fisheries Advisory Commission, and then if that's blessed, this will be used by NOAA for decision-making. So I don't know who our representative is on the Marine Advisory Fish Commission, or if the state actually even has one from the state government perspective, but there are at least, I think, Washington representatives on that. But anyway, the question is a process one. Let's suppose that the commission here felt like those goals are a little shy and should be a little bit bigger. How does that input get into the process so that the Marine Fishery Advisory Committee could at least hear a different perspective before they vote on this and before, I don't even know if it's accurate to say, gets locked in and NOAA decision-making, because the killer whale is an example of how dynamic things are anyway and, you know, everything changes.
Great question, Commissioner McIsaac. What I would recommend is that we set up a meeting with Governor's Representative, or Governor's Office Representative, Mr. Norman, to talk about some of these issues that you've raised. He's been involved in the killer whale, Southern Resident Killer Whale Task Force support, so I know he's aware of those and some other things. And I would suggest that we have that conversation with him now and talk about opportunities for amending those hatchery objectives, if that's the direction you would like to go, rather than sort of wait till the end and try to influence it at the MAFAC level. I think it's gone by then.
Yeah, Guy was at the last meeting.
So if you would like to do that, I know you have a relationship with Mr. Norman. I'd be happy to facilitate a conversation if you'd like.
Well, I guess it's for the front table here if the full commission is comfortable with a comment that the hatchery return goals ought to maybe be looked at a little closer, or some of the stuff that Commissioner Graybell brought up.
I think we should act on this. I don't want this to go forward in the condition it's in without having some input. I don't think it's, I'm, like I said, I'm very nervous about this being the final document that NOAA operates from for the state and the Columbia River. Yeah. Go ahead, Kim.
So as I'm listening, a question comes to mind. It seems to me, and this is really on that long-term scale, as we're doing recovery, the goal is going to be to actually, production will become more dynamic because we're going to want a greater proportion of the surviving natural origin that's going to be developing as a result of recovery compared to hatchery production. So how is that built into talking about production in these goals?
So that's a great question. So right now, for the most part, we're Washington is constrained through marked selective fisheries that target hatchery fish have incidental impacts to wild salmon and steelhead in the Columbia. So as these goals change, those indirect impacts would increase. That would increase our harvest rate on hatchery fish. And then eventually, as we achieve healthy and harvestable, we are envisioning that there are opportunities for directed fisheries on healthy wild populations, which is sort of where we laid out the policy in 99 and extinction is not an option, that's where we'd like to go.
And maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything in your presentation about the pinniped issues or avian threats to recovery.
So that's a great question. The exercise was a little bit more focused on goal setting, and it hasn't got down to what are the actions that we need to do to achieve those goals. And there's going to be pinnipeds. We heard some talk about cormorants before. There will be talk about, as Chair Smith talked about, hydro system survival. We're going to look at all of the actions that we think we need to do to sort of reach those goals. And that's where that will come in.
First of all, I would want to agree with
my partner, Mr. McIsaac, on setting numbers high rather than low. And second of all, I think you have to remember, thank gosh for the Nez Perce tribe in our part of the world, because they have done things that we got to remember not to get bogged on in process, because the Nez Perce tribe were trying to bring back coho to our part of the world, and everybody kind of scoffed at it that it wouldn't work, and because this, they were extinct. 3-4 years ago, we had a fishery on them. We had a fishery on the Rond on salmon that hadn't been for 40 years. So I think the fish are a heck of a lot more resilient than what we give them credit for. And there's times we got to just run with it. And there again, if a run in our part of the world, the Chinook, there again, my gosh, Don, you made a really good presentation to us where it bottomed out in what, the 70s. And now we have very good fisheries on those fish. So I think we need to not worry about process. We have to be part of it, but that we can't limit ourselves, because in our part of the world, the fish are a lot more resilient than anybody ever give them credit for being.
I think what you're hearing is a commission which would like to do as much as we can as quickly as we can. And this frustration isn't directed at you. From my perspective, I sit here as not having a 40-year fish history and listen to many, many, many groups go through sort of the same process that you're doing, all with acronyms. I've started trying to put them into pots, but what I'm wondering, as you get to phase two, and I'm actually asking our director this question as well, we're told all the time to think of, to try to work like a business. And usually I don't like that analogy because we're not a business. But I was reading an article, I was trying to drag it up on the phone while you were talking, about one of the things that Google has done, and that is develop a whole office that's in Bend, where they bring together their best thinkers, and they're not spending years coming up with goals. They're throwing out outrageous ideas. Just, this would work to repopulate salmon or steelhead, and then they're working through them, and then they go. Then they actually take every idea seriously. And then they start adding the limitations, and maybe the social limitations, the funding limitations, the whatever limitations, and they rank them. And then they find projects. One was a self-driving car, and that, you know, happened a long time ago, and they had trouble with that. But I would like to see at least one of these organizations that's considering these, how to recover salmon for real, not just creeping along, do that. And present it to us and others so that we can see that everything's been thought about out. Because as far as I can tell, we are spending a lot of time, and a lot of people like you are spending a lot of time doing things. To me personally, whether we have high goals or low goals on there, if we get somewhere down the road on the goals, if we keep our trajectory going that way, I'm going to feel like I did my part. But what I'm trying to say is that this commission is pretty energized over this. We just heard this morning, you know, the habitat, the local governments aren't working with us as they should. It's very checkered about how local governments deal with things like clear-cutting trees. We hear every day many things that we can and should happen, and I don't think anybody's really looking at that in a more sort of pie-in-the-sky way, and I'd kind of like to see that. I think we're limiting ourselves as we start, and I think that's a little bit about what Commissioner Graybill's frustration is as well. So that's just trying to put these comments in perspective. We really want to do what we can.
Yeah, I think that's
summarizes it.
Yeah, and I would agree with Commissioner Baker here. You know, this is built all on old models, and part of the frustration that I've expressed is that the adherence to old models that aren't we're not seeing the results that we have been anticipated. And again, I don't want this to get too far down the road without the ability to interject some revolutionary new thought in this process that might get us there before these timelines that I've seen. So again, thank you very much, Dan, for this presentation. It gives us a lot to think about, and I would encourage a meeting with the governor's representative as soon as possible.
We'll talk about that in the next agenda item. I think that's a good thing.
Okay.
But thank you, Dan. I think you get a sense of our support, enthusiasm, and frustration.
Sure. So, thank you very much for allowing me to make the presentation, and thanks very much for the comments. They resonate with me as well. I think we're all feeling some frustration, especially in the Columbia River, over the past 3 years with declining runs and declining opportunities. And I think we have to keep moving forward with the recovery plans that we have. And we do have some recovery plans with some actions. And if you're interested in that, I would suggest that maybe work through some presentations with each of the recovery boards that actually have detailed recovery plans of this reach, we plan to do this, and we expect to get this type of benefit. So I think if we want to keep our foot on the gas on this, it's largely about some restoration. It's about some changing some hydro operations, and the restoration part is the challenging part because it's about funding. And funding in this climate is challenging to get. So thank you again very much.
We're going to keep our foot on the gas.
Thank you. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.